from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, what medical tests can reveal about your health and your future? Journalist David Ewing Duncan spent much of the past few years having his blood, organs, and DNA tested, even though he's perfectly healthy. He wanted to know what high-tech diagnostic tests could tell him about how his past life affects his health today and could influence how long he lives. His new book, Experimental Man, reveals what he learned about personalized medicine in the course of being poked and prodded in the name of science. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny. Well, if you're like most people, you avoid taking medical tests whenever you can, especially uncomfortable procedures like colonoscopies. But our guest this hour spent months undergoing dozens of blood tests, body scans, and futuristic DNA tests, even though he's perfectly healthy. He was looking for clues about why people get sick or die and what his present health might say about his future. When he's not being a human guinea pig, David Ewing Duncan reports for Public Radio's Tech Nation, and he's director of the Center for Life Science Policy at UC Berkeley. His new book is called Experimental Man, and David Ewing Duncan, welcome to Forum.
Glad to be here.
How are you feeling this morning?
Well, I have a little cold, but other than that, I feel fine.
Yeah. So tell us about this project you underwent for, what was it, over the course of 2-3 years?
Well, it actually started way back in 2001. I did a Wired story, Wired magazine story, right after the Human Genome Project was announced. And as a reporter trying to figure out how do you report on this strange new world of DNA and genetics, and I got this crazy idea, maybe I should have myself tested. And that was really wild and radical in those days. And I was able to talk a company into doing it, and that got me hooked in a way on this. I probably, you know, have a curiosity gene or Pandora gene maybe, which has not yet been discovered. But that got me going on this process, partly as a reporter trying to humanize a story and partly as just a human being curious about all of this.
And you went well beyond genes. The genetic testing, you had blood tests, of course, and body scans, and you were physical exams as well, your hearing, your eyesight, your taste, I believe, was tested,
even
all those
taste
things. So how much time did you spend getting tested? I mean, what was a basic week like?
Well, I did. The book is divided up into four sections. It's genes, environment, brain, and body. And I spent the better part of the last couple of years really getting most of the tests, and then some were done in the past. The first chapter in the genes is not a genetic virgin because I had done this before. But there's an index at the beginning of the book, which I shamelessly take from Harper's index, yes, called Experimental Man Index. And it gives you the liters of blood, which is almost 2 liters, actually.
Numbers of body toxins tested for, 320.
Right.
Hours spent in an MRI, 22.
Yeah, and I really don't recommend that to anyone. I mean, it seems to be safe, according to the scientists, but it is really boring to be laying there on your back with a blanket over you, being asked questions. And as soon as I lay on my back, I want to go to sleep, which
yeah,
in fact
even,
I did.
But although it sounds like there's a jackhammer in your ear.
That's true. They give you earplugs, but that's what the machine is clicking and all kinds of roars and strange noises. And
well, how did you go about it? I mean, I assume your insurance company didn't pay for these tests because they weren't recommended by a physician or prescribed by a physician.
No, and that's still an issue with some of these tests. Many of them, and we can get to this, are not ready on the one hand. On the other hand, they're still not paid for. But the tests, I figure, cost around $150,000 if you had to pay for them. And that's mostly because many of them are prototypes. They are not yet available. And I had either magazines like National Geographic or Wired pay for this, or I got the labs to run them for me as a reporter pro bono.
And what kind of warnings did you get from either your personal physician or the people administering these tests? Because as you say, a lot of them they're not reliable necessarily. They're experimental, as your book's title suggests.
Right. I think what we're looking here really is a glimpse of the future. A lot of these tests, even as soon as a couple years, a year or two, some of them, a few of them are available in good tests now. Most of them, we're talking about a 5 to 10 year scenario here. But I had to actually convince many of these researchers who are careful people, and many of them from major universities, including here in the Bay Area, I had to convince them that I would handle this information delicately and impart the fact that many of these tests are not quite ready yet. And I think it's important that they're almost ready. And in fact, as a policy person in my program at Berkeley, we're working to try to push an idea of a comprehensive plan to make some of these tests available, to push them that final mile, if you will, to make them useful for people.
Give us an example of some of those tests that are sort of right on the cusp of being useful and available.
Well, I'll tell you one that was useful to me, and it's not yet out there. I got several genetic tests done for heart attack. This is in the realm of my little ticker here that's beating here in the studio inside of me. And I didn't believe a lot of this information because much of it was very preliminary, you know, certain risk factors for heart attack. But there's a company in South San Francisco, and I'll name it. It's called Intellos. And these guys do computer simulations of what happens inside of a human body when you try out a new drug. A lot of drug companies use them to run simulations. And eventually, hopefully, you won't have to test as many humans if you can run these on computers. So they developed a product, and I was the only one tested at the time. They've tested a few people since. And they factored in genetics, cholesterol, heart CT scans, ultrasound of some of my blood vessels where cholesterol might have accumulated. In other words, dozens of risk factors. First time this has ever been done. And much to our surprise, I came up with an extraordinarily high risk for heart attack based on this study. And when I went to my doctor, I started this whole venture here, this journey, with a visit to my internist at UCSF. And he, among other things, declared that I had a very low risk for heart attack.
So it was contradictory information.
Yeah. So this was useful. Well, it was also useful information. And part of this is convincing the patient that it's useful. Now, you can tell a person to stop smoking, but unless they're convinced that they need to, it's not going to mean anything.
And what was the basis of this increased risk?
Well, the basis ended up being genetic and part physiological. It turns out that if you want to know the specifics, the liver doesn't uptake cholesterol very well. And they were able to, through this fancy computer algorithm, figure this out. But the point is that
Let me just stop you. Yeah. Couldn't they just take test your serum cholesterol?
Well, actually, I got a very complex cholesterol test. It's called particle distribution cholesterol. And we don't have to get into the gory details of that. But basically, there's not just one type of cholesterol in your body.
Cholesterol.
Well, it's good and bad, but it also – it's a dynamic in your body. The cholesterol is delivering lipids throughout your body. And as it does that, it gets smaller and smaller. And they measure these different sizes. And in my case, I have a ton of small particle cholesterol because my liver doesn't uptake it. That's when it's supposed to be sucked back up into your liver and reprocessed. Anyway, probably more detail than we need. But that was revealed by this test, which if it was out on the market, would cost a few hundred dollars. And for somebody that, say, had high blood pressure or elevated cholesterol, I mean, think about this for our healthcare system. A test that could give you that kind of information for a few hundred dollars versus an $85,000 heart bypass operation.
But how many people would be like you? How many patients would they actually find that? In other words, there would be a lot of negative test results.
Yeah, in fact,
which
most
case,
people.
Maybe, most people. So
probably.
You can't really screen everybody. You'd have to take people maybe who have some other indication for risk.
Well, and this is what needs to be done in a comprehensive way. And I'm thinking that we need something like a human genome project for this area, which is called personalized medicine. It's focusing on you. You know, it's going to be different than me, and running tests like this. And you need an indication. You know, maybe it's when people hit 50. You know, they should have, you know, like a prostate exam, you know, PSA or a mammogram for women. You know, it's now pretty apparent that when you hit a certain age, you should get a certain test. But the point is that the power of these tests to predict disease is on the cusp of actually being useful. And I think as we're having our healthcare debate in the country right now, or at least the president would like to, he keeps being distracted by little things like the crashing economy. But this might be a way to spend a little bit of money up front and find out the answer to your question. You know, would this test benefit
us? Be cost effective.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And so what you, your physician said you're at low risk for heart attack, and then you get this fancy test results back, and you, so you took it to your physician. What did he say?
Well, he was surprised by that. And in fact, he was very skeptical, as I was. You know, I'm a good journalist here. I mean, part of the book is almost consumer reports of what is useful here or not. And I, neither of us, my physician or I, expected me as a healthy person, 51 years old, you know, come from a reasonably healthy family. We actually thought that I would come out pretty clear, which is one outcome, of course. And this test was a bit of a surprise. And I even know, because I tested genetically my parents, my brother and my daughter, so I can see from my parents that they, you know, bless their hearts, gave me their hearts. They gave me the worst possible condition for genetics that I could possibly have, given, because they're a carriers for some of these heart attack risks, if you will. And they happened to give me exactly the worst scenario.
Worst combination.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Your brother, Don, younger brother, is there's a lot of reference to him in the book, and he's less fortunate than you genetically. Tell us a little bit about him. He has a bone disease that is quite mysterious and very troubling, obviously, for him.
Well, there's a picture in the book of the two of us. I'm 7, he's 5. My mother's standing there, and this is back in the 60s when we were little kids. And we're dressed alike. We look almost identical. But deep down inside of my brother Don, there was a genetic glitch. And this is there to show people, and I talk about that. I've never written about this before, but this glitch causes him to have brittle bones. And it's probably osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a disease that causes you to not produce collagen properly. And collagen in your bones is what keeps it stiff and you know, keeps you from breaking bones easily. And we don't really know exactly where this came from, but I did take this case to one of the world experts in OI, this particular disease, up in Seattle. And we each had our genes sequenced, the genes that were applicable here for producing collagen. And sure enough, my brother came out with some problems, although we're still not exactly sure. It doesn't fit into the normal pattern. But this is a story of an investigation to try to figure out why my brother, he's basically disabled now, and he breaks
the
bones very easily.
Condition.
Yeah, over time, he's in his late 40s now, but this began to really affect him in his 30s.
So all the testing you got, was any of it of any use to him?
Unfortunately, no. And this is because with many of these rare genetic disorders, and we need to make a distinction here, most of the tests I had are for a healthy person. And because I've reached the ripe age of 51, it's unlikely that I have a major genetic disorder. You know, we may still have some things in the future here, but mostly what I'm going to have genetically are low risk factors for things like heart attack, or medium risk factors, and the environment plays a huge role. And in fact, in that heart attack test, I didn't really finish it. If that scenario of me having a heart attack only happens if I gain a modest amount of weight. If I don't, then the risk goes down.
So that's really useful information for you. You can keep your weight under control, and that risk more or less goes away or subsides to normal?
Goes down about 2%.
2%.
Instead of 70%.
Yeah, so there's some incentive.
Yeah. But the type of disease my brother has is a rare disorder, and this would be something like Huntington's or Parkinson's, or, you know, smaller numbers of people get them, and they usually manifest. We knew that something was wrong with him even as a child. We didn't know about the genes or the disease. But so there's a difference there, and I want to, you know, that needs to be emphasized with the tests I'm taking are for a healthy person that give you some predictive value. It's very different from my brother.
We're talking to David Ewing Duncan. His new book is called Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, Your Health, and Our Toxic World. Speaking of toxics, you went back, you were tested for chemicals in your body and found out that you had a very high level of PBDEs in your blood, which is a flame retardant. What did you do with that information? So it was surprising, I assume.
Right. Well, yeah, this is the environment section of the book. And I was tested, as you mentioned at the top here, for 320 chemicals. And I got a couple of surprises. One of them, which came out of, totally out of the blue, was these flame retardants. And they're the bromide chemical family. And they're literally in this studio here in listeners' homes. They're everywhere. They're in your mattress. And they're actually there for a good reason. This is not a pollutant. This is a chemical that's required by law because it saves lives. It retards flames. That's what it's there for. What was unexpected for the people that put this stuff in all of our products is that it actually does get inside of people and actually other animals and throughout the environment.
But in your case, that's not necessarily where you got it from.
Well, it looks like – well, I'll tell you –
In terms of you didn't get it from your mattress.
Yeah, I'll briefly tell you. I called the world expert on this who's in Sweden. He called me. I was in an airport and he said, I have bad news for you. You have very high levels, 12 times the normal level. These are higher levels inside of me than people who work in the factories that make these chemicals. And he started asking me, did you get a new mattress? Because, you know, new products tend to have more of this stuff in them. You have a new computer. The plastics in computers sometimes throw off these bromide flame retardants. And then we got to airplanes. And I fly a lot. And obviously airplanes are drenched in flame retardants. And since that phone call, this expert, name is Aki Bergman at University of Stockholm, he's run a number of studies with people flying, and he's done blood levels before and after they take a long flight. And sure enough, they spike way up. And the body gets rid of these things at varying rates, sometimes months or years. But that may be my source of exposure here.
Now, you also say in the book that you went back to your childhood home and looked in Kansas, and there were issues about the environment. A river near your home was very polluted. So what did you try to figure out the connection between the high levels of PBDEs and where you grew up?
Well, the PBDEs are a newer chemical. They really came out after I was in my late teens or so. That was an additive that was started more in the 70s, so that's fairly new. But I I grew up in a very idyllic place on the edge of Kansas City in eastern Kansas. It was a lake. We had woods. You know, we played. Kind of place where you left your keys in the car at night, and very safe place. But about a mile away was the Kansas River. And on the Kansas River was a toxic waste dump that turns out years later when I go back to report on the story. I mean, imagine this as a journalist. It's a great journalistic find, horrific for me. This is a major EPA Superfund site. Hundreds of millions of dollars were spent to seal this. And when you look at the EPA reports, and they're online, you can look at the list of toxic chemicals that they found in this dump. And some of these show up in small trace amounts in me years later, like pesticides and dioxins and some other chemicals. And we can't get too far along here without me saying that these are really, really small amounts. It's not like I've got, like I drank a cup of dioxins or something. And nobody really knows what these small trace amounts, how they affect or if they harm humans. But they're inside of us.
Yeah. And coming back to the PBDEs, is that is that the conclusion then, that it comes from all the flying you do?
It may be.
Because that makes me wonder about flight crews and pilots. I
mean, well, those are people that are being tested. And again, these are still small enough amounts, even at the elevated amounts I have. The elevation is compared to the average exposure. And there's still no evidence. These are thyroid disruptors. They're carcinogens in animals. But that's at very high levels. And one of the – there are many kind of calls to action in the book and in this project. And one of them is I think we need to press the powers that be to do more experimentation and find out what these small levels really mean. And there's some interesting things going on that scale. We obviously can't test humans for toxicity. I can't give you, higher and higher levels of flame retardants until you die, because that's how they test these things in animals.
So when you got that information, is there anything you can or should do about it?
Well, we are doing something as a society. Actually, these particular type of flame retardants have been banned or phased out. In California, I think last year, the final – there are several types of these, and the final one was actually banned, I believe, in 2008 in California. Washington State has banned them. Europe has banned them, and the company that makes them has voluntarily phased them out. But these products will be around for a long time, and one important activity that we can engage more in here is in the green chemical realm and coming up with safer chemicals.
Which is very much happening in California.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you want to join our conversation here on Forum, we're talking about personalized medicine and several months or years, really, of testing that our guest went through, David Ewing Duncan is the author of Experimental Man, and if you'd like to join our conversation, tell us about tests you've had or would like to have. What would you like to know about your level of toxicity? Do you obsess about it? And does an hour like this make you obsess more? 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Was there a particular test that gave you a lot of anxiety? Was there a result you were worried about?
Well, most interesting, we haven't talked at all about the brain scans, the 22 hours in the MRI. This whole realm of what's essentially reading your mind, if you think about that, these machines in a very crude way are reading our minds. And I had what they call structural MRIs, which is looking for disease. They're measuring different sizes or the shapes and sizes of different parts of your brain. And I came out fine. You can look for things like Alzheimer's, schizophrenia. There are actually evidence you can see in these MRIs. So I came out fine on that. The part, though, that made me a little nervous was what they call functional MRIs. And these are looking for blood flows in your brain when you're shown an image or an emotion is raised in your mind. Like one of the tests showed me a lion roaring, a picture. I'm in the MRI and I'm looking at this little screen. And that, of course, activates the fight or flight parts of your brain. It's an old part of your brain in the back.
Adrenaline.
Right, exactly. And the blood begins to rush to those parts of the brain because they're being activated. And that's what the machine measures, is that blood flow. And in that particular test for anxiety and fear, which was done at Stanford, but I was also tested for greed, for risk-taking, for belief in God, for what products I like or don't like. And
And there was an interesting result on that one because you looked at, movie posters and DVDs, and you gave answers to whether you liked certain movies or artists, I guess, and you had a conscious answer. But then they measured your brain when they showed you these things, and there was some disparities between what you said or what you liked and what the tests were showing that your brain was reacting to.
Right. And this is what makes you nervous because, what goes on deep inside of your own mind is your own business, really. It's your own secret. And so this outed me. This is a case where my brain outed me. I was shown a poster of Pan's Labyrinth.
The
film,
Spanish movie.
Right, about post-Franco Spain, very dark, violent art film.
Guillermo del Toro, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's, it is a brilliant film. And I, as a writer and pseudo-intellectual with quotation marks on either side of that, of course, I was supposed to rate these on a little box between 1 and 8. So I put 8, love that film. Boy, am I an intellectual. But unfortunately, my brain did not agree with that because my brain actually liked the movie Dodgeball.
The most.
Yes. Better. Much
not
better.
Not very intellectual.
Yes. In fact, it loved it better than any of the other products I was shown.
So when you say your brain and your brain showed also you didn't like Pan's Labyrinth. So
right.
Was that the truth? You really didn't like it? You were just saying you liked it?
Well, what's that measuring is the level of activity in my brain. And one thing it tells you is it's not that there was no activity for Pan's Labyrinth, but that would actually activate more of the rational intellectual parts of my brain, the new part of the human brain in the front. And, those movies, Ben Stiller movies are designed to, push you, kind of below the belt, emotional, fart jokes or whatever else. And so, of course, it activates that emotional part of your brain. And that test just simply measured that a movie like that I'm probably not alone in that. It's not that I don't intellectually appreciate Pan's Labyrinth, but my brain is much more attuned to Dodgeball, the movie.
Did you see The Orphanage, which is another movie by him?
No, but I know about it.
Yeah, troubling, very troubling.
Yes, yes.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation with David Ewing Duncan, author of Experimental Man, in the rest of the hour. And you're welcome to join us. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email your comments to forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny, who's nursing a bit of a cold. And my guest this hour is David Ewing Duncan. His new book is called Experimental Man. And we're talking during the break, David, about sort of the link between your genes and the environment. And there's an expression that you quote in the book, which is something like your genes load the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. What does that mean, and what did you learn about your body and genes and the environment that you've lived in?
Well, I think one of the most important bits of news, if you will, coming out of the book is we've had, at least in the research community and even in the media, we've had this obsession with genes. And genes are only the beginning. It's the blueprint of the house. It's not the house. And what makes the genes activate and what interacts with the genes is what happens in the environment. And in a way, evolution has created the human organism to fend off and protect itself from lots and lots of environmental, you know, potential harms, like even UV rays from the sun, even oxygen. You know, it's a toxin at a certain level. We need it to live, but it also is very hard on our cells. And so, what I've done in the book is I've checked myself out for a whole range of potential sensitivities in my genes to environmental factors, including these toxins I tested myself for, and found out, I think like a lot of people, that I have certain sensitivities and certain protections based on my genetic profile.
After, you know, putting all these tests, you know, in the balance, do you feel better about your health and your prospects for longevity?
Well, it verifies something that I probably already knew, which is that I'm basically a healthy person. It's giving me some hints of what's to come for me and for all of us as this technology comes online. For instance, I did get a test for mercury, and I did a little experiment. And one of the rules in the book was do no harm to me.
And that was doctor's rule.
Right. That's right. And I only violated that in a small way a couple of times. And one of them was I actually start the book out going fishing.
Halibut fishing.
That's right. Off of Bolinas, you know, north of here, went out with a great fisherman named Josh Churchman, who took me out on his little boat. And I caught a halibut, and I had that for lunch one day. And I had a swordfish that I bought in a market for dinner. And I did a before and after mercury test. And our main exposure to mercury comes from eating large fish, not small fish, but large fish, because mercury accumulates as the big fish eat the little fish. And so I did a before and after blood test, and I went from 4 parts per billion, which is safely below the threshold that the EPA suggests. And that was before. After, I spiked up to 13 parts per billion just from these two meals, which put me well above the safety threshold for the EPA. But then I took another step further, which was to check my gene, you know, my DNA, to see if I had any of these markers that show sensitivity to mercury. And in the book, you'll read that I'm fine, protected.
Yeah.
But since then, I've discovered I have a couple of markers that may make me a bit sensitive to basically, these are genes that allow your body to expel the mercury quickly. And it looks like it may hang out a little longer in me than in some people.
Yeah. And is that really useful? I mean, you probably wouldn't be eating halibut and tuna and swordfish 3 times a week, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it could be incredibly useful. These tests are very preliminary.
Particularly for women, I would think.
Yeah. Well, already the EPA and FDA and other agencies have guidelines for especially women of childbearing age and infants, because mercury is a very bad thing to have hanging around, especially in your brain. And the type of mercury that appears in the environment called methylmercury does tend to head into your brain. And the idea, or one of the theories is about neurological disorders caused by mercury, is that some of us have a genetic proclivity to hang on to this mercury longer. Our body doesn't flush it out as well. And this is incredibly new science and needs a lot more work. But it actually could tell people a simple test like that, you know, in the near future, people, it may be okay or it may not be okay to eat large fish.
Let's go to the phones now. And again, that number, if you want to join us, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And Asmi is on the line in Moraga. Good morning.
Good morning. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes.
I am driving.
Go ahead.
A question for you. I am a 52 years old male, very healthy. All of a sudden came with diabetes, type 2. I have no family history of that. I am not overweight. I exercise. I pay attention to what I eat. And no family history. And I'm trying to figure this thing out. There has to be something in a food or chemical.
Or genetic.
That.
Yeah.
Is any information on that you came across or you know anything about?
Well, one interesting aspect of personalized medicine and a lot of these new technologies are allowing us to see that diseases like diabetes are not just one disease. In fact, diabetes could be almost an individual disease for people that have different mixes of genetic risk factors and environmental risk factors. And on one end of the spectrum, a very small percentage of type 2 diabetics, actually it is predominantly genetic. But most people who get diabetes, it's environmental. And there's even an ethnic part of this as well. People from South Asia and Central Asia tend to get diabetes more than people from other parts of the world. And that's you know, opens up a whole lot of interesting questions, but that seems to be what the science is saying. So in your case, it could have a genetic component. It could be, when you reach a certain age, this was something that was just waiting to happen, and you've triggered it by something you've eaten. Some people just get diabetes even though they're eating well, and a lot of work needs to be done on this to understand it.
Asmi, where are you from? Where's your family from?
I am originally a Middle Eastern. I'm from an Arab descent, Jordan. I'm an Arab.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So not South.
I don't know of research that's been specifically done on the Middle East on this, but certainly South Asians, even lean, fit South Asians tend to get diabetes more than say, people of European descent and East Asians and Africans get it less than all of the above.
Well, Asmi, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking this call.
You bet.
Thanks for checking in. We got an email here from Kara who writes, I want to know how he acts differently as a result of all this information on his health. Are you detoxing?
I have gotten many suggestions since the original story I wrote on the toxins for National Geographic, many suggestions, some of which are really interesting. I want to emphasize here, though, that my levels are really not a lot different than other people's, and it just depends on how worried one gets about having these very, very low trace amounts of these chemicals. I did, however, to finish off what we were talking about earlier with a heart attack profile, when I found out I have a very high risk of heart attack if I gain a modest amount of weight, I did adjust my diet. Just a little bit. I'm not a big diet person, so it needed to be pretty simple. And I dropped about 10 pounds, and I'm hoping that I keep on the no weight gain trajectory because for me that almost zeroes out my risk factor.
But it's important to note that these are sort of probabilities, right? I mean, they can't say for sure, although I think – weren't you told you were going to have a heart attack in the year 2017 if you gained a certain amount of weight? I mean, that's an incredibly specific prediction, but that's really more accurate than we can be based on these tests.
Yeah, that's me really punching home as a journalist. headline. It is probabilities, and that particular one was if I gain a lot of weight, if I gain 5 pounds a year, if I become a very large person. That's any news to anyone that if you suddenly put on about 30 or 40 pounds, that increases your risk for heart attack. Although for me, it's basically a death sentence according to that profile.
Yeah. Was there anything that you learned that you didn't share with us in the book?
Actually, there was nothing that I didn't put in the book, although as I say in the introduction, I was prepared, because this is not just me, remember.
It's your
family. We have the experimental family, as I call them, my experimental parents and brother and especially my daughter, who's 20 years old. And I agree with James Watson, who was the Nobel Prize winner, discovered the double helix back in the 50s, and he was one of the first people to have his genome scanned. He withheld a couple of pieces of information, including his Alzheimer's results, because he was afraid that his children might be worried or scared. And in a way, I could be doing something incredibly dumb, which is revealing a lot of this information that my children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren will regret that I ever did. Although – I would hasten to add here that I think that this information, it won't be that hard for people to access your DNA, and we're getting into the privacy issue here. But it's important that we pass laws that protect that information.
And in fact, former President Bush did sign a law protecting the use of that information to be used against people in terms of insurance and that sort of thing.
Right. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was passed last summer. And we're working in our center at Berkeley on analyzing that. And it has some protections but still has some holes in it as well.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. 866-733-6786. And Judith is on the line in Walnut Creek. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I'm wondering if any research that you've done shows anything related to the autoimmune diseases that people develop.
Well, there is some work being done on that. In fact, even in diabetes type 1 is an autoimmune disease where your body starts attacking the pancreas. I didn't specifically test that in me because I don't have any known autoimmune diseases, but there is work being done on a broad spectrum of different scientific approaches, including genetic, for that. But I don't have specific information on that.
We have an email from someone who writes, I have a 12-year-old child with Asperger's autism. I'd like to know if there are blood tests to know the levels of any toxins in blood. I'm not sure what she means by that, maybe related to those diseases.
Well, there are
questions about mercury.
Right, right. There's a lot of questions and controversy over the role of mercury, especially in vaccines like thimerosal, which have been removed now from vaccines. But this is a question that we're not going to be able to get into here in any detail. But I believe with the research I've done and the experts I've talked to, that when you get a disease like autism where you have children that are exposed to the same environmental factors and some get a disease and some don't, or some get an allergy and some don't, it's clear that there's some kind of difference in those children, and it's probably a genetic sensitivity. And in some cases, that's being researched now at the National Institutes of Health. They have a new program that's been going for a couple of years. But it's a huge area that needs to be investigated. And even in my research for this book, in finding my own mild sensitivity to mercury, it may be that in fact, is an explanation for some of these neurological diseases. And I think it needs to be investigated and understood. And it may be that everybody's right in this controversy, that in fact there is a sensitivity. It may not come – vaccines, when they did contain mercury, that was one source of mercury. But if you have a sensitivity to mercury, you might get it from any other number of sources.
That wouldn't necessarily affect other people because of that sensitivity.
Exactly.
There were some quirky little test results that you found, in particular one that I think you said you appreciated the most, which was you found out that you have an ability to metabolize caffeine efficiently as you grab your Starbucks cup. I think it's Starbucks. Do you drink a lot of coffee? Was that a concern for you?
Well, I wondered why I could drink coffee all day. I love the taste of coffee. It's sort of my morning ritual to get up and make it. Why could I drink coffee all day and it didn't seem to affect me? And my father admitted this to me recently too, that he's been able to do that. So this is clearly hereditary. And it turns out there is a gene. It's my favorite gene, or one of them anyway, the caffeine fast metabolizer gene. And this apparently allows my body to process caffeine incredibly fast. I can have a cup of coffee before I go to bed and go right to sleep. And I know people who don't have that ability, that probably isn't annoying that someone else can do that. But
yeah. Well, Danny Bringer, our engineer, is saying that you do that as well all day long. Yeah. So I guess but then what's the point of drinking it? Does it give you the stimulation that most people drink coffee for?
I just have to drink more. It still does. But I actually just like the taste. I like having a warm beverage. I sit there and write all day. It's, sometimes it's tea, sometimes it's coffee. Let me add one thing, though, that's interesting about that, which is there was a front page New York Times story last week about the president's budget director, President Obama's budget director.
Peter Orszag.
Right. Yeah. And in the second paragraph of the profile of him, they were talking about his hair color and the shirts he wore and the kind of person he was. Oh, and he had the caffeine fast metabolizer gene. And to me, that means genetics has arrived. It's just simply another descriptive element in a profile of a person.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Lauren is online in San Francisco. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I just wanted to say I work as a biostatistician at UCSF here, and I just wanted to mention that it's really difficult to extrapolate population-level risk factors to individuals. And I just think that there's a danger to misinterpretation of some of these test results if they were available to individuals, that there really is a certain confidence interval around these elevated risks statistics, and that a person may be, you know, at 12 times the risk for something, but still may be that person that doesn't get it. And I think it's just important to
talk about the limits of
the utility.
Data. Yeah.
Yeah, and the utility of the test. Is it really going to, you know, tell someone something that they can use to change something, or is it just going to make them scared for the rest of their life?
Well, and you know, you point out in the book that that you knew that a lot of these were very experimental and with limited value at this point, anyway.
No, but it's worth emphasizing that especially these genetic markers are very preliminary in most cases. you know, they're probably in the low dozens of markers out of the many thousands that have been produced by scientists that have any real validity or usefulness at this point. And the caller was completely correct. Most of these are taking populations and they're comparing people who have a disease to those who don't and trying to find out if there's a gene. And you may have 100 other things going on in your body that prevents that gene from actually causing you to have a risk for heart attack, for instance. In fact, even with all these fancy tests I've had, it's probable, in fact, because there's very little heart disease in my family, that I have as yet undiscovered risk factors inside of me that are preventing me from getting a heart attack.
Well, Betsy writes to us. She's concerned about your heart health. She writes, have you had yourself tested for levels of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, either from plasma or red blood cells? These polyunsaturated fatty acids are associated with a number of disease states from cardiovascular to neurological.
Well, that's one test I haven't had. And I think, you know, that's on the list now. I should go out and do that.
Are you pretty much trying to exhaust the list, go through them all? Are there tests you just won't have? You mentioned in the book you haven't had a colonoscopy, which is such a common test.
Yeah, you know, that one somehow just keeps slipping down the list.
And that's one you actually can
use
the information.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, that's
one of the most important.
Yeah, no, it is important. And I have seen a virtual colonoscopy, which seems more in tune with a high tech, and that doesn't actually mean, you know, sticking something in, you know, the nether regions. But, no, you could go on forever on these tests, actually. I mean, I think conservatively probably in the, you know, a couple hundred maybe at least. And I have so much data now to sort through. It could take years to even understand the tests I've done. But there are a few I would still like to take.
All right. Let's go now to Jesse is on the line in Orangevale, California. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Scott. Fascinating show. Thank you for having it.
Sure.
I work in an industrial environment in which I'm exposed to a variety of pollutants, namely diesel exhaust, diesel fuel, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. I've been concerned for some time over what my body's absorbing, and I'd like to know if somebody like me with, you know, I basically have average health insurance, you know, I can't afford copious amounts of tests to be done, but I'd kind of like to get an idea of maybe what I've picked up over the years. Is there some sort of test that I can take? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks so much, David.
Well, unfortunately, most of these environmental tests, because it's so hard to detect these small levels of toxins, are very expensive. There are a few that are fairly simple, and you could ask your doctor, and they would probably sign you a script for it, something like a mercury test or a lead test. I do know that there are some it's a priority right now at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, you know, in the federal level and also in California, to look into diesel exhaust. That's becoming a major focus of some environmental testing. I think it's mostly air quality. But unfortunately, it's not easy to get some of these tests. My test for the National Geographic Project cost around $15,000, and you certainly aren't going to have insurers, I think, paying for any of this, really. A mercury test, though, lead test, which, you know, if you work in a place where there's diesel fumes, you know, you may be exposed to lead as well. That's fairly easy to get, and it's very well characterized. There's a lot of literature on it, and that's probably a $30 or $40 or $50 test.
We were talking earlier about the flame retardant chemicals, PBDEs, and there was an article, Dan Zoll, our producer, handed me an article from yesterday's LA Times. Flame retardant chemicals that have been linked to reproductive and neurological problems in animals have seeped into coastal environments, even in remote regions, and have been found in high concentrations off populated areas such as Chicago and Southern California, according to a federal study released yesterday. Based on what you know, people who live in those areas, is that something that they should be concerned about and get tested for? Or, like in your case, it's, you know, not that much of a concern, really?
Well, that's a very expensive test, unfortunately. It's one of those that it's about $1,000 per chemical, and there are three main types of these bromide flame retardants that, depending on the product they're in, you know, the chemical makeup, each one of those would be hundreds of dollars at least. And it it's not clear that – yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to scare people, and we shouldn't scare people, because that a study like that is based on toxicological data, mostly from animals with very high levels and much, much higher than we have inside of us. And there is some interesting science going on trying to figure out what these small trace amounts mean. But at the moment, we're sort of stuck. And in fact, it's interesting. They found PBDEs in the Arctic. They found it in, you know, in polar bears. They found it everywhere on the planet.
Hmm. What does that mean?
In small amounts. Well, it just means it's pervasive. It's out there. It takes a while for it to break down chemically. And it's not the only chemical, but there are many of them that have been found throughout the globe.
All right. Let's go now to the other side of the country, Portland, Maine. Tim is on the line. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
So I have a question. So there's results. We can find how much cadmium we have in our blood. We can find arsenic and mercury testing for drug metabolism. And there's a lot of people that will offer solutions or results or chelation, for example, to assist with detoxification, autism, for example, with mercury. What's your experience, and what would you say to the individuals that are offering for treatment in heavy metals or treatment for detoxification?
David?
Well, I want to, you know, make it clear that I'm not an expert here, and I can tell you what the experts have told me. Most physicians recommend something like chelation, and that, of course, is adding charged ions into your body basically to try to flush out metals. And it, unless it's done very carefully, it can actually be dangerous unto itself, because you're flushing out metals that should be in there. You know, your body needs metals like potassium and magnesium, iron for your blood. And so it's something that a lot of people ask me about, and I think people there's a range of those that are very in favor of it, even on a regular basis for a normal person. But I think you really need to consult the literature and your physician for something like that. Again, for most people, these are such small levels, it's probably not going to hurt you. But we need to find out more about what these small levels do. It may be a long-term harm that we don't know.
All right, Tim, thanks for the call. Now let's go to San Rafael. Beverly's on the line. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. You've spoken to my question here in the last couple of questions, but I was also interested in mercury. Both me and my sister have multiple sclerosis, but a very mild form. And I was curious about getting mercury testing, because I eat a lot of fish and I have a lot of dental fillings with mercury in them. And our dentist used to actually let us play with the mercury and roll it around in our hands.
You know what, Beverly? We've got kind of a wobbly connection, so I'm going to let you go, but maybe David can respond.
Right. No, I think we got enough of the question there. I don't know as much about MS. I do know it's sometimes cited with as potentially influenced by environmental factors, but I'm not clear what that would be, and probably should let an expert talk more about that.
Got an email from Susan, who writes, isn't there a danger to relying on genetics? I was diagnosed with invasive lobular breast cancer at age 47. And 2 years later, my mother was diagnosed with the same rare form of breast cancer. I wanted to say that, she goes on, it's kind of a long note here. I have two sisters and a niece. It seems to me that genetics is an evolving field. Aren't we likely to discover more genetic predispositions that we know of than we know of today?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're just at the tip of the iceberg here, really. This is early days for a lot of this information. And in fact, we have thousands of genetic markers that have been identified. They still need to be, and I think there's an urgent need to validate them. You can have a marker that says just because, you know, you have this marker, you have a certain risk factor. But that's still – most of those have not been clinically validated, meaning that you haven't run a clinical trial to see if somebody who has that risk factor actually does get the disease. And so, yes, I mean, breast cancer, it seems like, you know, every other week or so there's some new markers coming up. There are literally dozens of them. And I have a section about that in the book, because we do have breast cancer in a small way in our family. And my daughter, I came up with a high risk factor for some breast cancer genes. which of course is not a big deal for me as a male, but my daughter also did. We came out negative for the main breast cancer test that has been validated for two breast cancer genes. But that's an open question even in our family.
Yeah. All right. We're short on time. Let's see if we can sneak one more call in here. Elaine from Alameda. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if you were aware of the 216A ratio of estrogens that many women are not aware of. They usually go for their pap smears, but they're not aware that they can test for an unfavorable good-to-bad estrogen ratio.
Yeah.
That is an important test that's done in the urine.
Yeah. Of course, this raises a point. You probably didn't have a lot of the tests that women would have.
No, and you know, I've had a couple of volunteers to be the experimental woman. My daughter was tested, and my mother, so we did get some of those tests. But no, a test like that, which is more of a protein or a biomarker test, I did not have.
Yeah.
But,
so this book is really to look into the future, not only your personal future, but the future of medicine, the future of genetics testing. Where does it all leave you? Are you feeling hopeful, scared, not just for yourself, but for us as a culture?
Well, I think it's almost for me. I personally don't get scared about this information. Mostly, some people might. Some people might even get paranoid about some of this information. So you have to really judge this for yourself and how you approach this. But I think philosophically, it does raise a number of questions, not the least of which is, how much do we really want to know about this intimate information? We've never known this as a species before. And there will come a time, I write about in the book, a little device that, again, stealing from Apple, but there may be something called an iHealth one day. That's what I call it, which actually it's a little, device like a handheld iPhone or something that tells you everything that you need to know about yourself every day on an ongoing basis and gives you probabilities if you eat that fish or not. And, do you want to know that much?
It can drive you crazy. But on the other hand, that's where we're headed, like it or not, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much, David Ewing Duncan. His new book is called Experimental Man. Thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer, who drinks a lot of coffee. We found that out. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. Dave Iverson is here tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.